Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Before we get to the fun, here's a quick word from one of our sponsors.
And so how do you feel when you wake up in the morning after taking a sleep cocktail?
I feel like working out.
you feel like tackling the day.
Right. I feel like I'm about 20 years younger.
Don is a sleep cocktail customer in San Diego, California. And he didn't always wake up wanting to work out. His work schedule made getting a good night's sleep impossible.
I was not feeling rested when I'd wake up, and it was having a drastic impact on my health. I was always injured. I wasn't waking up in the morning feeling like exercising, so I didn't. It was affecting weight gain. So it was kind of one issue on top of the next on top of the next.
Do you wake up ready to tackle the day? Try Doc Parsley's sleep cocktail. Go to robwolf.com/sleepcocktail and use code ROBWOLF10 to save 10%.
Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Today I'm talking with Elijah Markstrom, who is a top-tier obstacle course racer, personal trainer, and co-founder of the wildly popular The Obstacle Order podcast. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Super excited to have you here. You've done a ton of personal experimentation, which we talked a little bit about before recording. We also have a mutual acquaintance, Matt Brown at NorCal yes. Strength and Conditioning, also known as Mateo Cafe. And so great
Mateo
guy there.
Cafe.
Mateo what? Cafe.
What's that about?
Just Matt Brown, kind of in Spanish, but completely bastardized Spanish. Yeah, yeah.
So okay, I thought there might be a story to it.
No, not really. I would just, when I was still at the gym, I would walk into the gym and when he was there, and I would scream, Mateo Cafe! And just kind of stuck. And
right on.
You know, people generally didn't know what they were getting out of me from day to day. So they just kind of like smiled and nodded and waited for me to leave. So,
yes, yeah. I know how that feels. I've been that guy.
Nice, nice. So, Elijah, you have a really pretty varied background, clearly pretty heavily focused in obstacle course racing right now. But give folks some of that background. Like, you did some pretty good track and field in college. What's your, I guess, athletic background, coaching background? You know, what's kind of formed that path that you're on?
Right on. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I started out as a, you know, very young kid interested in any sport, right? Baseball was my first love for sure. Started playing baseball when I was like six. By the time I got into high school, I didn't necessarily specialize, but I was leaning more towards track and field. I was having a lot of success. I was always the fastest kid, right? Like, you know, you race down the breezeway, you know, you before you get into organized sport, you know who's the fastest, right? Kids always want to determine that. And I was the fastest at any, whenever I was in school. So by the time I got to high school, I was doing football and track, and I wanted to play basketball, but I am actually only 5'6". So basketball was not a strong future.
Not
for
playing
me.
To your strengths. Yeah.
Not. I thought I was pretty good, but they didn't see me being varsity ever. So I ended up not playing basketball. And my track coach was like, look, man, I know you, and you need to be doing things or else you're going to get in trouble. So you need to sign up for wrestling so that you don't have an entire off season. So I started wrestling my sophomore year. And so it was varsity wrestling, football, and track all through college or high school. And then when I finished high school, I went on to do college track.
And that was at Chico State, right?
Yeah, Chico
nice,
State.
Nice. And then what did you study in your undergrad at Chico State?
I got a degree in exercise physiology.
Okay. So you knew Tom Fahey and all those guys.
Fahey, oh yeah, the infamous Fahey.
Man, God, I love that guy. He's super good friends with Dan John and can
okay.
tell you all kinds of stories from like anabolic substances to the protein research that he does, and just a hilarious, super cool guy. So yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, Fahey's a nut, and he's really interesting because he has a pretty like lenient stance on like steroid usage,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and it's pretty controversial. And then Dr. Azevedo, do you know?
I know Jack? Dr. Azevedo. Yeah. Yeah.
I love that guy. His exercise physiology course was so nitty gritty, going down all the pathways and everything with, mitochondria and all of that. And then, but he would make you understand it from the conceptual standpoint. So all of his tests were essay format.
Mm,
It was actually my favorite course, his exercise physiology course.
Yeah, he was. I think kind of the terror of the exercise physiology program. Like, there's always like that one class or the one professor that you're like, oh, dude, I'm not really. You know, on the one hand, you look forward to it because it's going to be challenging. But a lot of people are like, I don't know if I'm going to pass this. And Azevedo was kind of that guy within the exercise physiology program. And I was not when I did my undergrad, but when I came back and was poking around potentially doing some graduate work. And talking a little bit about some of the paleo stuff and lower carb and everything. And he hated me. He just wanted to be shot on sight. Yeah.
I could see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He did the research for Cytomax and the just heavily carb, you know, maltodextrin, all that. Yeah.
And he's like a super lean, super carb tolerant dude. He probably has like 3 pancreas in his body, whereas I have like a quarter of one. And so I was like, and I remember I was talking to him and Fahey. And I was like, you know, I just feel like shit if I do that. And he just looked at me like I was an alien. He's like, you just got something to sell, you know? And I was like, no, really, I feel like shit. So yeah. But good guy, super solid guy, really super knowledgeable. So how did you just basically transition that exercise phys background into your career path? I mean, you enjoyed doing all this stuff and then that kind of set the vector for the your career life after that?
Yeah, so you know, my track coach, so okay, I had sort of a roundabout way to Chico State. I went to a school called College of the Siskiyous up mm-hmm. in Weed, California, and then Moorpark College down in Southern California. And you know, I was a pretty good athlete, in terms of my on the state level in Oregon. I won the state championships in the 100 meter. I got second in the 200 meter. And my coach told me, he's like, look, I know athletes and I know you. And it's like, you just need to pick a topic you will be interested in that you will continue on and keep going. So when I set to get an exercise physiology degree, I didn't really have a plan of what I was going to do with it. But by the time I was a senior, I was like looking at various jobs, like, you know, selling insurance, working for random companies that make uniforms, all these things that go to your career fair. And one of the companies that went to my career fair is called Equinox, and they're a pretty high end gym.
Mm-hmm.
They came down from San Mateo and essentially did like a little recruiting, and I started off with them and pretty much never look back. And I'm now kind of like a private trainer. You know, like I run my own business out of studios, and I do trainings in homes. And, I've been doing that for 10 years now.
Nice. So you clearly are on the fast twitch side of the spectrum athletically.
Right.
I usually find that most folks that are on that kind of fast twitch spectrum tend to be maybe a little carb intolerant sometimes. Would you say that that's the case with you? Like some problems regulating blood glucose levels? Like Charles Poliquin has talked about that a bit, that more fast twitch kind of, to be dominant type folks maybe are kind of predisposed to a little bit of a glucose, a disposal problems. Where do you feel like you're actually at on that spectrum?
Well, I don't know if this is sort of the making or the maker, but like when I was in like all the growing up, I was crazy about sugar. I would eat, I would basically go collect cans, go down to the Dairy Mart, buy 100 penny candies, just sit there and eat penny candies, just straight. I'd make little balls out of them, eat them like an apple. Cereal, I'd be pouring sugar on. So I was, you know, having no knowledge of any of this stuff, I was just eating sugar constantly. And so...
So that theory may have gone completely out the window then, because clearly it wasn't, you weren't like feeling laid up for a day after cracking out on this stuff. Like you just like hammer it down and then Wolverine style, like pop up and like, okay, I'll go for another round.
Well, when you're, you know, 10, 12, right. That's easy to do. I would say that it was something that if I was not aware of the problem, but sometimes I would feel sick and I'd be like, oh man, I would always gravitate towards a glass of milk to try to feel better. I'd fall asleep, wake up, do it again. So in retrospect, like these are like typical patterns. If you do sort of like now when I overconsume sugar, I will quickly fall asleep.
Okay.
You know, within a couple hours. But in terms of like weight gain or anything like that, I haven't noticed issues, you know, probably because I remain so active.
Right.
But like, I think I'm more sensitive when it comes to things like gluten, beer, like yeast, things like stuff that causes bloating and water retention and stuff like that. But like, if I go to a regular sort of mixed diet that is higher carb than fat, I can handle it. But I can't eat candy all day and not get tired.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
So you're not totally Wolverine, just maybe some Wolverine-esque tendencies then.
Yeah, and it wasn't until I started to realize like that there's other ways to eat, probably, I don't know, 6 years ago. So I was typical. I would wake up, I would have, you know, I think about this all the time when I listen to your stuff. I looked at the cereal box, I read it and I said, okay, 7 to 10 servings of grain a day. That seems like a lot, but I'm going to do this because I was trying to gain weight and get bigger and do what the thing said. And I didn't know any better. And I'm 16 at the time. And that set the stage for how I was going to be eating all the way up until after I finished college. So I was eating 2 pieces of toast, in the morning with, you know, eggs. And then for lunch, I would have either a burrito, giant burrito, or a couple pieces of pizza. Dinner would probably be the same thing. And then on the weekends, I would add an extra burrito around 2 a.m., if you know what I mean.
Right, right. I did many of the Yaka Taco drunk dining exploits in Chico, yes. Yes.
Yeah, and I did generally feel poorly back then, and I didn't even know it. And it wasn't until I met with a nutritionist, and I was having issues with my skin, and she says, "Look, your skin, the reason why you have a problem with your skin is because of what you eat." And I was like, "What are you talking about? What do you mean? Like, how is that even possible?" And she's like, "Yeah, if you eat a lot of sugar and you eat a lot of these different things that you might be sensitive to, you'll get, you know, essentially an immune response," and that was the first time I ever actually changed my diet in any way, because I was always just worried about body composition, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what I did there was I actually cut out all grains, and I didn't even know what it was at the time. I was just eating fruit and meat. That was all I did.
Right, right.
And I did that for about 6 weeks, and I felt amazing. And I was like, okay, now there's something to what you put in your body and how that makes you feel. And then it was really a matter of going down a lot of different roads to see what worked. It was always like seeing if I could handle gluten, seeing if I could handle beer. Cause like I was still into that. I was 23, 24, really wanting to incorporate those things into my life because it's part of the fun of
absolutely being, particularly in Chico, where it's like there's nowhere else to go. You either go to the Bear or Riley's or something, and that's just what you do. So
yeah burgers, yeah. Stuff like that. Yeah,
right. So what was the progress or process then? Like you kind of inadvertently ended up on kind of a fruitarian paleo diet there for a bit, and then right. You know, where did it progress from there, and what was kind of the inputs that would cause you to test one variable versus another?
Okay, so after I was on that approach for a while, I got down to 143 pounds really quickly. And I was like, okay, clearly I'm not eating enough. You know, I usually sit around 150. Okay. And so I dropped a lot of weight, and I started to figure out what can I add back in. And, you know, this is probably before paleo. This is before anything where there was like as much as before Facebook, right? There wasn't as much attention paid to diet, I think, in terms of looking at alternative ways to do it. So I just started to figure out things on my own. So I would add back things like oatmeal. I would just try to stay gluten free, you know, eat a lot of nuts, just kind of get my volume up. But I was still really hungry like every couple hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I hated this, okay? Because I'm, you know, I work as a personal trainer. You have stretches of sometimes 5-6 hours where you can't
even pee, let alone eat.
Seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it ended up being, okay, well, which bars can I eat, right? So I would eat like the Clif, they have these protein bars. And, you know, which things I can eat that are gluten-free, but you know, I'm not paying attention to other aspects of it, like how much carbs there are, for example. And so I'd have all these bars, but I was always hungry. I'm always hungry, and I hated it. And I would, if I missed a meal, it was like, watch out, right?
Right.
So fast forward a little while, I start looking into more, I guess, alternative approaches to eating. And my friend, he says, you know, wouldn't you love to just like not have to eat all day and not be hungry? And I'm just like, oh, that would be amazing. And he describes to me the ketogenic diet. And I had never heard anything of this. And I was like, that there's no way that will work, you know, i.e. talking about Azevedo and,
right.
those concepts, right? Like, there's no way I can do this and still function. But what I ended up doing was actually going on the carb backloading protocol. Are you familiar with
yep.
that?
Yep.
So I figured that would be like a sort of a middle ground, I guess. And I had really good success with it until it became a little laborious to eat that much like crap in one sitting. You know, you would have to have like 500 grams of carbs in 4 hours.
Right.
And you feel good on your non-carb days. And then the next day you feel kind of crappy after the carb backload, but I was still able to maintain like decent performance on when it comes to my workouts and things like that. And I was also, my objective was to gain weight and decrease body fat. And I ended up at 156 pounds and 6% body fat, which was the most lean and heaviest I ever had been in my life.
Right.
But I think where you kind of, I guess, tuned into this journey that I was on was when I started working with Grace. She saw me after I had been doing carb backloading for a year and was trying to transition out of that because I was still having a lot of issues with my skin, with, you know, sleep disruption, a lot of bad sleep, things like that were still going on. So I was managing my body composition and having some good days and some bad days, but it was starting to turn around and not work for me anymore. I think it was probably because of like eating an entire pint of ice cream, eating an entire gluten-free pizza, eating a full bowl of white rice or two, you know, chasing that down with some, you know,
cocaine, basically. Yeah.
I don't know, whatever, but it just got to be kind of crazy. But, yeah. So I stopped doing that and changed to kind of like, I listened to your podcast with, Chris Kelly on the Keto Summit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And your approach is what I sort of bridged into, which is like more, you know, like lentils and beans and just sticking with slow digesting carbohydrate, but still getting in that 50 to 60% of the calories coming from fat. Taking a more stable, steady intake of carbohydrate. And that's what I did for quite a while when I was working with Grace.
Gotcha. What type of, Did you guys do any like gut biome testing, your urine organic acids testing? I mean, I know you started playing around with the superstarch, and I will in the show notes for this link to that podcast. I told Elijah before we started recording, I've listened to that podcast like 6 times because it was just really interesting. And you went through a pretty interesting process of essentially being kind of keto fueled and then shifting to more of like a 30% carbs and kind of repartitioning things post-workout. So that was actually super influential for me because I've still been trying to crack this nut for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. But what did you do on the testing side to kind of inform why you were going to do A versus B?
Okay, so what we did was we did a pre-intervention U-biome.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they sequence your microbiome. And then I was really, really off. All right. I'm not as good at talking about this as Grace. She's like a computer.
She's the only female that I've met who almost has an Asperger's level of detail on this stuff. It's absolutely crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's just say I was reverse of what you should be. So the
Firmicutes were high and bad. Yeah.
It was like inverted. What's supposed to be 70-30. So I've got here. So Firmicutes was, so my post intervention data, Firmicutes was 55, Bacteroides was 27%.
Mm-hmm.
But then pre intervention, it was 53% Firmicutes and Bacteroides was 8%. And you want to have less Bacteroides, right?
Right.
So we added various fibers and probiotics, and then we just basically did a month, and then we pre-tested, and then we post-tested at UBiome. And then it was mostly qualitative, you know, like I took notes every day of how, you know, some of these side effects of these fibers might be like lightheadedness or dizziness or sleep interruption or gas or bloating. So I just monitored all those things with daily notes to just kind of give Grace feedback.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And immediately what I saw was improved sleep.
Interesting. Okay.
Dramatic sleep. But I was not measuring ketones or – actually, I was measuring blood glucose at this time, but not ketones.
And you were still ketotic while doing the bionic fiber, though.
I'm not sure. You know, it's interesting. I think that – you know, I never did a ketogenic diet for, you know, weeks on end. It mm-hmm. was always some type of – where I would introduce carbohydrate, but I certainly got into ketosis cyclically.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I think that's probably because, you know, I feel like you can get into ketosis very fast if you are exercising and do high intensity exercise.
Right.
I think as soon as you dump and drop your glycogen stores low and don't refuel with carbohydrate, unless you're really metabolically deranged, I think within a couple of days, you're going to get into full-on ketosis, maybe one day, if you're not then switching back to a high-carb approach, right?
Right.
And so I think you can get away with a lot more. So I was probably in ketosis while maintaining like 100 to 150 grams carbohydrate. And I think a lot of that was because most of my carbohydrate was coming from beans, lentils. I wasn't eating a lot of rice, right? And so I think that my insulin levels were staying pretty low still.
Right.
And also some of the actual fibers, like the glucomannan, will actually decrease blood sugar levels.
Interesting. It totally makes sense. And this is theoretically some of what you want to do with like the superstarch and stuff. Like theoretically, you're getting a very modest, if any, insulin response off that. And so a lot of the kind of keto fueled people will use that peri-workout. But, you know, I really started poking around on like some of the lentils and some things like kidney beans and like the the insulin load on those things are really remarkably low. And a lot of people are going to be like, yeah, no duh, idiot, you know, paleo dude, you know, but I have noticed that, like lentils I can do pretty good with, kidney beans I do pretty well with, black beans will give me acid reflux in like one meal. Garbanzo beans give me acid reflux in like a meal or two. So there's still some variability there, and I'm trying to figure out the ins and outs of that. I did submit a eubiome, but it got lost, and I never have gotten back in and you know, done that process again. So I've been completely slappy in following through on that. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. They're like, yeah, we have no idea what happened to it. So
that is weird that the black beans are, so these are, you're eating them by themselves
I'll do them with a mixed meal, like some protein and some veggies, but you know, I'll be pretty consistent. Like I'll have some lamb or some beef and either lentils or black beans or kidney beans. And so I've kind of matrixed it out in that way. And even ages ago, I remembered that black beans would frequently, like I'd noticed that I would get some kind of acid reflux off those in particular, whereas like lentils and kidney beans, just no real problem there. I do still notice a little bit of like foggy headedness sometimes and a little bit of roller coastery blood sugar levels. And I still suspect there's something not quite right with the gut. And
yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like you don't have enough of the bacteria that are responsible for breaking this stuff down. So it's creating like almost like a blockage. Mm-hmm. Like one thing. Okay, this is weird, but if I had a large bolus of black beans, I could feel it. If I'm palpating around my large intestine, I could feel a ball there that stuff has not been broken down like the next day. Like it's not fully been processed by the bacteria in the colon, right?
Right.
And that can take a couple days. So it's like, maybe like it would be interesting to see what your values were, because you could then talk to Grace and say, hey, which one of these correlate best to breaking down the type of like resistant starches that you're going to find in like a black bean versus like a lentil or kidney
bean.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I need to finally get in and really get quantifiable on all that stuff, because I keep hovering around this kind of ketogenic state, which is kind of a it's a safe place to go because the gut issues resolve, my mental clarity is good, but it also seems like it keeps me pretty squarely, you know, stuck in this spot. And I went to a Keto Gain seminar, which was outstanding. Those guys do a really phenomenal job. And I've been tinkering with taking much higher electrolyte doses and some things like that. And that has definitely improved some things. But it's still really easy for me doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and trying to keto fuel that whole process to start feeling super adrenalized and kind of smashed after a training session. And, you know, soccer combatives, like they just really... They're, you know, weightlifting and legit endurance activity both seem to kind of lend themselves pretty well from an energy perspective to some sort of a ketogenic or, you know, like targeted ketogenic approach. And then these mixed modal activities like combatives, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, MMA, it is squarely in that like glycolytic process. Like you're just begging for problems, not adequately fueling the glycogen restoration and it's I'm still a work in progress. Theoretically I know something about this stuff, but I feel like a complete idiot.
It's tricky. So it's like, this is something I've been thinking about with my own diet. So we had the Spartan World Championships at the beginning of this month on the first, and I was largely fueling in higher carbohydrate for, you know, my workouts were long, pretty intense. You know, when I run, I'm sitting at about 85% of my heart rate max for, you know, say an hour or an hour 20. So, you know, you're going to get contribution from sugar on that. So you do have to fuel with sugar. And then you have to also get to be prepared for the high intensity efforts where you're doing interval training or something like that. You want to make sure that tank is full, right? But it wreaks havoc on the system, right? Mm-hmm. When you elevate the carbohydrate, especially when I'm trying to do it quickly. I need to have short digestion windows. So sometimes I have to, you know, I can't be eating black beans an hour and a half before I am about to do a high intensity workout. I need a couple hours to digest, right? So I might find something like brown rice, white rice, granola, something that is easy to digest so that I'm not doing all these workouts on an empty stomach. But what I found was I just didn't feel great. So since then, in the past, you know, I don't know when this will post, but do you care if it's time stamped at all? This episode?
No, it's doesn't need time stamping at all.
Okay. So it's, you know, 3 weeks later and I've been delving back into ketogenic type approach. Like for today, I haven't even eaten at all. I had MCT oil and with my coffee and that's it. Right. And I feel great. I love it. I feel so good. But as soon as let's say I go for a run right now, my heart rate's actually going to be higher relative to the pace than it would be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what I was starting to notice when I introduced carbohydrate back into my diet, I was having a decrease in the total, what I would consider the stress load of that workout. So I was getting in staying aerobic a minute faster than I'm running right now while being ketogenic. So I could theoretically probably run longer in this like sort of non-carb fueled state, but I can't run as hard at the same heart rate.
Right.
And what really shifted me was when I was actually trying to get high intensity and run uphill and stuff like that. When I was fully ketogenic, it wasn't happening. It was like there was a brake that was put on at about 155 beats per minute heart rate. And it's just like, you're not going over this. Because if you do, you're not going to be able to go because you don't have any carbs in the tank, right?
Right, right. So, you had a really interesting analogy with that there was like a governor driven by the heart rate. Like there was some sort of a feedback system that your body, your brain, your leptin levels, something knew that the glycogen stores were inadequate to keep you hammering at the pace you wanted to hammer. And so it would automatically ratchet up the heart rate such that you couldn't right. access that intensity, which I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, it's like an overheating mechanism. And then you pull back. You go, whoa, what's going on? I'm really ramping up here. And then you pull back and you get back into that safe range. You know, and that works if you're running an ultra marathon, and that works if you're not having spikes, but it doesn't work it doesn't work for obstacle course racing, that's for sure.
Right.
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 Because you're going, well, first of all, you're running that thing at 90, 95% heart rate or 100. You know, the goal is to be able to run at VO2 max the whole time.
Right. Right. Which is a blistering pace, just super nasty. And how long do these events typically last? I know there's variability on that, but how long are you pushing these things out?
Man, so the race I just did, I was expecting to be in about 3.5 hours. It took me 4 hours. And that's the longest one, okay? So this was going up the mountain at Squaw Valley. And you're going 4,000 feet, about 16 miles with 30 obstacles. But a more normal race is about 90 minutes, it's anywhere from 45 to 90 minutes. So they have different distances. With my sprinting background, building up the ability to maintain a high intensity for a long time has been the hardest part of the adaptation to the sport.
I was going to ask you about that. Like, how does your training look at this point? I would assume that because of the sprint background, you did tons of weight training, Olympic lifts, plyometrics. So like that ability for you to just turn shit on is probably super well wired up. But the movement efficiency and then also developing some of those other fiber types and enzyme systems has probably taken a lot of work. Like how do you parse out your training?
Oh man, it has taken a lot of work for sure. I mean, when I first started doing this training, I hadn't ran more than 6 miles or more than like 10 miles in a row, like ever. So to ask myself to do a 9 mile obstacle course race was a big ask. And I had to develop my aerobic system. And that was part of why I was tinkering with the high fat diet, was to have the capacity to build up that aerobic system. So, you know, right now I'm splitting, you know, pretty traditional. I'll do, you know, maybe between 35 and 50 miles per week running. And then I'll do at least like two fully dedicated sessions to strength training, like with weights, you know, just to keep my strength up with squats and stuff like that and deadlifts. And then I do strength training specific to obstacle course racing. So that's carrying a bucket on a treadmill. That's carrying a sandbag up the hill. That's doing a lot of heavy loaded continuous movement. And then there's high intensity intervals at, you know, submaximal, you know, so let's say 160 beats per minute for anywhere between 6 and 15 minutes, you know, let's say four times over the course of like an hour or something like that. And so I've pretty much taken out anything that's like super top end, like sprinting, like maximum sprinting, but I still have a lot of speed work. And then most of it is just making up the difference and building out my aerobic system that was largely neglected through my entire like athletic, serious athletic endeavors.
Well, when you're, I don't think I'm nearly as fast twitch as you are, but I'm a little bit fast twitch, and that to whatever degree that's an advantage. Like I seem to notice that people avoid aerobic training like the plague. And
would you run a mile if you could run 100 meters?
Right. And you're done and you beat everybody. And so it's like, So yeah, I totally understand it, you know, and it wasn't until I really started digging into some of Joel Jameson's Roadwork 2.0 and really talking about the need for that just dedicated kind of marathon pace. Aerobic development. And that's really all I do. And I lift some weights, I do some kind of math pace, aerobic work, and, you know, some mobility work. And then my intervals are actually doing the jujitsu. And, and it's a night and day difference. Like I'll get tired, but I'm never really like just smoked, where before I didn't have any of that, like, hydrogen ion clearance or anything. Like I would do 5 to 10 5-minute rounds, and I was altered for like 2 days after that. Like I just wasn't Whereas now, you know, I'm tired, but it's not that big of a deal. But I just had never developed that aerobic capacity, the cardiac efficiency, and all the rest of that stuff. Had completely ignored, you know, like 100 years of exercise science and the need to develop basic aerobic fitness before you start doing other stuff. So. As always, I was an idiot on that. So that's that's interesting.
Well, the base work in that aerobic, that like marathon pace, is actually what really, you know, took me from. So I was, you know, I was running, I could run like a 21-minute 5K. And my approach back in the day was I would take a distance and just try to run it faster every week or every time. And little did I know I'm delving into anaerobic by the end of that run.
Right.
Every time. And I'm really causing more harm than good. When I started to slow down and got a heart rate monitor, started paying attention, that combined with a little bit of more targeted interval work, I was able to drop my 5K down to, I ran a 16:40.
Holy smokes. Wow.
Which is like I'm not supposed to be able to do that.
Right.
With my genetic background, right? I'm running a 5:15 pace, which I used to only be able to do once. And I was, like you said, toast for, I'd have a sore throat for like a week.
Right.
If I ran an effort like that.
Right.
And so I think that a lot of people discredit the value of even just like a 45 minute steady pace. You know, people want to go, they want to go big or go home. They want to go super hard. You know, like CrossFit builds your conditioning, but it's such at a high end that a lot, like you see these guys do like a workout like Murph, and they're just absolutely floored. It takes them like some guys an hour slower than the other one, right?
Right.
And then Froning, for example, he got his ass kicked by some of the longer workouts, and he's supposedly the fittest guy on the planet, and he never ran more than 20 minutes straight. But I think it helps every other system because you increase, like you were saying, you increase your ability to bounce back and to do actually the quality work that makes you better at what you're actually trying to get better at.
Yeah, and it's interesting, not to polish the knob of the aerobic pathway too much, but it's one of those rare things too. You know, strength work plateaus out pretty quickly. Power work does. Like, it becomes a real shit fight to continue to improve a lot of those elements. But the aerobic pathway has years of development, and it can be kind of boring in some ways, depending on how you tackle it. Like, I tend to do what I call aerobic intervals, where I'll do like 5 minutes of aerodyne, 5 minutes of rower, 5 minutes of rope skipping. I'll do a little bit of jiu-jitsu mobility stuff that's basically just keeping me moving. And I'm pretty much breathing through my nose the whole time. Some of that, I can't really wear a heart rate monitor because just the way I'm wiggling around, it's not real conducive to that. But, you know, the more of that I do, the better that I get on the mat. And as far as that just kind of aerobic engine. And
that totally makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So so you are using a heart rate monitor. What variety are you using? And then are you also tracking heart rate variability at all to kind of check in on recovery?
Okay, so my heart rate monitor is the Garmin 220. It's the Forerunner 220. It requires a strap still. But I found that I just wasn't getting accurate readings from any of these ones that measured optics.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I would have them side by side. You know, I'd wear them. I'd go for a run, wear one, wear the other, check my pulse with my finger, and it was never accurate with any of the light, the one that uses light to measure your heart rate. For heart rate variability, I haven't gotten into the actual heart rate variability, but what I do every single morning is when I wake up, I take my resting heart rate. So I have a sleep app called Sleep Cycle, which is like so you put your phone on airplane mode at night, you put the phone on your bed, and it uses the accelerometer to measure your movements and kind of give you an estimate of what you're doing in the night. So it can tell you which stage of sleep you're in. And one of the features it has when you wake up is it uses the light. Well, it uses like the optics, like I was just describing, to take your resting heart rate. So I take that every day. And if it's high, I know that I'm not fully recovered for my workout. And maybe I need to take it a little easier that day, or even use, like, when you talk about Maffetone, you can be all the way at the edge of that threshold. For me, that's 147 beats per minute. Or you can go at a 130. There's a big difference for me when I run 130 than I do run 147. So if I have like a, you know, my resting heart rate's 38. So if I wake up and it's a 45, I know that day is probably not a good day to hammer intervals and do anything high intensity. I might want to ratchet back. And that's how I use the data.
Gotcha. Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's super good stuff. So it just to kind of circle back around to the food before we wrap up. So you're just playing with this pretty loosely, like if you've got more of an aerobic pace day or maybe a recovery day, it sounds like you're maybe fueling a little bit more on the ketotic side. And then you're just kind of targeting carbs based off of need for more intense activity, and then also within your periodization for the sport, are you generally doing carbs pre-workout, post-workout? Like I've thought about this a couple of different ways. Like my sticking the carbs in post-workout lends itself to lower insulin load due to, you know, non-glucose or non-insulin mediated glucose uptake and all that type of stuff. But I'm almost looking at it as I'm fueling for tomorrow's workout today.
Right.
How are you slicing all that stuff up?
Oh, geez. That is a difficult quandary, I have to say. Right now, my workout intensities are low. So basically, I go like ketogenic for all day. And if I want carbs at night, I take carbs in at night. If I don't feel the need, I don't take them. So if I start feeling sluggish and like, let's say I get a little leg burn by the time I walked up my stairs, I know, or I'm weighing in at, you know, too light, I know that I'm low on glycogen. And so I'll just then eat a, you know, a bolus of carbohydrate and just go based on that. But for the most part, like during the week, I'm not taking in a ton of carbohydrate because my intensity on my workouts is pretty low right now. And I feel a lot better when I don't eat. Like, I certainly don't eat carbs in the morning unless I have. So normally on a Wednesday, I do my high intensity workout. On that day, I would take in, you know, something like I do fine with oatmeal. So I'll maybe take an oatmeal and like two eggs. That'll be my breakfast. And then like 2 hours later, I'll do my workout.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm not working out, I just do, you know, bacon and eggs, maybe some greens, broccoli, cauliflower, a little butter, or nothing. I've been playing around with not eating a lot lately. You know, I went from, I've been doing like intermittent fasting kind of to where I won't eat until 1 or 2. Some days I'll eat right away. I'm doing a lot of like mixing it up and just keeping, and then I might have 8 hours between the next meal. Like, I'm trying to make my body be able to be resilient to any circumstance and not fall off the shelf. Because I think when you're super reliant on food to control your blood sugar, you are kind of up against it. Same way as if the blood sugar hammers you when you do eat, you know, too many carbs or something like that. That's not good either. So I want to be very versatile in what I take in and be able to kind of deal with anything. So I'm not going to go 3 weeks with never eating a carb. And likewise, I'm not going to go 3 weeks constantly eating carbs.
Right. No, I love it. I love it. One of my favorite papers, Secrets of the Lac Operon, it basically, it really cool paper. It's open access, easily read even by laypersons, basically makes the argument that that metabolic flexibility story, you know, that we should be shifting in and out of fat-fueled and glucose or glycogen-fueled metabolism, and that it should be a reasonably easy transition. It shouldn't be like hitting a brick wall one way or the other. And if there is that brick wall kind of phenomena, then it you know, like for me, still need to dance around the carbs a little bit, probably some gut dysbiosis that's causing some endotoxemia and some inflammation and some insulin resistance, or maybe just the, you know, direct like neurotoxic effects of some of this stuff. And then, you know, so I really dig what you're doing. And I think that that's a laudable place to look for both kind of like that really narrow wedge between like performance, health, longevity. Like, I think that you could get a lot of mileage out of all of those vectors by, you know, targeting the macros in a smart way and kind of forcing the body to be able to deal with whatever you throw at it. I really like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, over my like journey of messing with my diet and going different extremes, what I've noticed is when you, like, if you go too low carb for too long, you kind of like cause more insulin resistance. You can't handle the carbohydrate.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that works if you're ever planning to use carbohydrate in your workout. And to me, I can't divorce the importance of performance and completely, right? Like, I get it. For the guys who are all they're doing is sitting around writing books and they never go for a workout, well, ketogenic is going to work for them all the time. There's no reason why it wouldn't, right? But if you're getting up and going, you can't tell me that you can be 100% fat and still run as fast as I like to go during my workouts.
Right, right. Well, even these folks that are like, you know, like the Finian Volek type athletes, like they're doing some very targeted carbs, like sometimes like 100, 200 grams of carbs during a really big training day. The challenge that I've found with that is it really seems to turn into a calculus problem. And and for me with jiu-jitsu, like, I don't know if I'm going to have like three people in class and they're all 120 pound females, or if there's 15 people in class and they're all 19-year-old cops who are like, yeah. you know, like 200 right. pounds and they chew nails for breakfast, you know? And so yeah. it's,
so how many carbs do you need that day?
Yeah.
Is it 15 grams or 80 grams?
Right.
And if you overshoot on the light day, you're in this soup.
Right.
And you didn't utilize it.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So for me, I've found that to be a really big moving target, and in the best, kind of flexibility that I've had on that is just, again, usually like breakfast is reasonably low carb, similar to you. Like if I know that I've got a JIT session popping up around noon, then I'll try to have breakfast for me around 9 or 10 a.m. We tend to have dinner pretty early around 5 o'clock. And so I still tend to get like a 16 to 18 hour fast in on that, but I'll do a whack of sweet potatoes or maybe some lentils, and I'll put in some MCT oil with that. And that tends to push me through the training session. And then depending on how frisky the training session was, then I'll kind of, you know, structure carbs around that. So I've fiddled with that. And that seems to be about the best that I've got. And I've talked to Chris Kelly about this stuff. You know, it's like, I desperately want the like all day long mental clarity of ketosis while right. still being able to throw some carbs in, and that just may not really be possible. So
yeah. You can do it. Yeah. So this is, you're doing like a 9 a.m. and a 5 p.m. spread right now?
Usually 9 or 10 a.m. and then training, and then post training around 1 or 2 o'clock, I'll do kind of okay. lunch. And then because okay, having kids, like if I could, I would try to wrap up that final meal earlier and then have kind of a longer evening fasting period, but I can't pull it off. Like I'm already right. weird enough. My kids yeah. are going to disown me at 2 years old, you know? So I've right. got to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with them. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Got it. Yeah. That seems like a pretty manageable situation. I feel like the ideal is 11 a.m. and like between 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I rarely can do that because of my schedule.
Right.
And my workouts. But if I think that's like you get enough fasted state, there's not an extremely long time in between like when you're awake and when you eat and then the next time you eat.
Right.
It allows for a training session in the middle of the day, and then it gives you the flexibility to add carbs in the evening if you want, but and not just be toast. Like, cause you know how if you have a lot of carbs in the mid afternoon, you're done. You're
yeah,
done. You're sleepy. You're kind of, I find myself a little unmotivated.
Right.
I want some more carbs, you know, they start getting a little sweeter, you know?
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, that sounds like a pretty good situation. Do you mess around with actual fasting in the morning too?
Typically I just don't eat. I'll have some coffee, just plain up until that first meal. And, even within that, though, Bill Lagakos has been posting all this interesting stuff on circadian rhythm and kind of making right. an argument for earlier, more carbs, more calories in total earlier, which, again, if I didn't have those damn kids, then I could make my last meal at like 2 o'clock and I would be totally, you know, I'd have a long fasting period and I would get all my nutrients, you know, in super early to entrain that earlier circadian rhythm deal. But the closest that I've done with that is just actually having a larger breakfast, sometimes even a little bit earlier, which allows me to have more coffee, which I look as a bonus because fasted coffee consumption can get to be a little bit much. And then my post-workout meal tends to be pretty frisky. And then dinner is usually pretty light.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the like serotonin signaling and all of that. So setting the stage for that early and then having the high insulin sensitivity and then like a long post digestive period in the evening.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, you know, that's good, but that's sometimes not practical.
Not at all. Oh, dude, it's insanely unpractical, but it's another one of those annoying things where you're like, oh, here's this piece of information that I should right. try right. to incorporate, and it really in modern life it just doesn't lend itself well to that at all. Like it really, you know, fasting throughout the day and then doing more, you know, wind down meals in the evening is much more amenable to a normal lifestyle. And Bill and I have talked about this a little bit. I'm looking forward to getting him on the podcast. But, you know, these questions pop up, you know, is it more important to try to entrain early with the calories and potentially some carbohydrates versus you're getting some increased autophagy and you know, cellular stress signaling because you're fasting a little longer. And I mean, it becomes a calculus problem. And I don't know what the optimum is on that. Probably it's way too much fiddling and obsessing with minutia at that point relative to anything else.
Yeah. Now I've gotten to the point where you can read all the studies, you can come with all the strategies and all this stuff, but at the end of the day, like, you have to have a solution that's practical and works within the constructs of the 98% of the people who aren't doing this stuff.
Right.
And if you're going to live that way, you are sort of ostracizing yourself by proxy of the way that you eat, and that kind of puts you... It's stressful, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. Every day you're explaining your diet to someone. Every day you're explaining why you're eating at, you know, 2 instead of 11.
Right.
And it's just, like, tricky. So, like, I'm actually working on a book right now that is really incorporating the 3 aspects I think are most important, which is the physiological effect of food, the psychology of how what you're doing with what you eat and how that is affected by others and social situations and things like that, and then the practical application. And for me, it seems like it's easiest to not have carbohydrate in the morning because most people can find a way to make a breakfast, right?
Right.
Then at lunch, you're going to have more options if you start to know what to look for at various things like a Whole Foods salad bar, or even like something like Chipotle, where you can find black beans and meat and stuff like that. And then by the time you get to dinner, if you want to have something like more high index, because that's something you enjoy, makes you feel like you get a little break from your diet, there's less consequence because you're about to go to sleep and all of your insulin levels and all that stuff is about to drop anyway. And then you wake up low insulin, no carbs, extend that period. And you're basically extending your fat burning, like high level fat burning window all the way through dinner because of low carbs no carbs in the morning and then slow digesting carbs in the afternoon. And it gives you room to kind of mess up a little bit when you're at like a birthday party or
right.
something like that.
Right. Absolutely. No, I completely agree. And that seems like again, the Bill Lagakos factor aside, like that seems to tick about as many of the boxes as you can do in a pretty effective way. Like and you know, for me, I'm super gluten intolerant, and so I just need to be worried of just cross contamination. So that's enough of kind of a socially ostracizing thing.
Right.
I'll eat some rice. I'll eat some corn. I just don't want to go spend money on a meal and then I'm like spending the next 5 hours on the can, like, you know, bemoaning my life. And so,
right.
So then when you add that kind of ketotic, super low carb, wrinkle to the whole thing, it is a serious pain in the ass. And it is kind of socially ostracizing even and beyond just the gluten deal. So what's the name of the book and what's the timeline on that?
Oh man, the book is called The Stoplight Diet. And so the lights, red, yellow, and green, are correlating to what's going on with your carbohydrate management.
Nice.
And that book, I'm about halfway through the sort of, like, you've been lamenting about writing your book, I've heard. I'm halfway through like the bulk writing of it.
Gotcha.
Right. I still have to reference it. I still have to have it edited and all of these things. So it should be done in 6 months, 4 to 6 months.
Nice. Cool. Cool.
My first book. I haven't written a book before. It's hard.
It is no joke. Like you see all these people popping up. They're like, I wrote a book. And
right.
Like even me wrapping up the second one, I'm like, why in God's name did I do that to myself? You know, but yeah. Well, congrats on that. We'll have to get you back on the show when that thing's ready to come out.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Because I think that it's something that I looked at from, I've never been dogmatic about my diet. And so when I look at a lot of the camps out there, I think people get too far down their own little tunnel and they don't necessarily see all the angles when it comes to if you're not creating like an allegiance, like that's diehard, where does it leave the other people? Right. I feel like this is somewhat of an answer to that, because I have experienced the feeling of feeling like an outcast with my diet. And it's kind of, unless you're just going to say screw you to everybody, it's kind of hard.
Right. No, it totally is. It totally is. And again, like you throw some kids in the factor and you want them to not have wacky disordered eating, but you also want to feed them well and all that stuff. And, it's probably good that I had kids 10 years. If I had had kids 10 years earlier, I think I would have probably been nuts enough to make them nuts. But I think that we're at a spot now that we're navigating it pretty well. And like the girls eat really well, like they eat kimchi and liver and all kinds of stuff. But we have some gluten-free pizza and some gluten-free treats. I do feed them gluten-free. We've hit a few situations where like we'll be at a birthday party or we'll just be out with folks and all of a sudden cupcakes pop up and there's not a gluten-free option. And so they eat it and they seem to have no GI symptoms with it at all.
That's good.
So I'm super excited about that. I didn't really have those symptoms as a kid either.
Right. Me neither.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I just keep their exposure minimized. And then, you know, we talk about, hey, we try to get gluten-free options when we can. And the girls are savvy to that and totally cool with it. And we, you know, I don't think they're going to write a tell-all novel that's like my dad, the horrible paleo, you know, caveman dad or anything. So hopefully not. But yeah, I mean, the kid deal complexifies things. But, you know, you do a couple of years of kind of outside the normal eating and it just gets tiring. You know, it's like you don't want your food to be the topic of discussion the focal point and all the rest of that stuff. So yeah
and you also don't want to narrow your field. You only associate with people who are crazy about food.
Right
Yes. And I think that's not that uncommon either. But it's fun, man. It's fun to mess with it. It's fun to pay attention. You know, I'd rather be that way than mindlessly cramming fast food down my face and feeling like crap and not knowing it and then getting cancer and heart attack and dying.
Exactly. Yep. Both my parents had type 2 diabetes in their 30s and I seem to have some genetic predisposition that way. So yeah, I did a bunch of wound care on my dad when he had his first his toe, then part of his foot, then his whole foot, and then below knee amputation. And I did wound care on each stage along the way with that. And my dad was funny. He would make this like deal with the universe. And he was like, well, I guess they can just take my foot. And, you know, in his mind, if they took the foot, then this was going to deal with his, you know, uncontrolled type 2 diabetes and all the peripheral neuropathy and everything with it. And I was like, Pops, jeez. I appreciate the sentiment here, but this isn't fixing the problem. Like, you know, we're just going to keep whittling you down until you're basically a torso and that's all that's left. So,
My gosh.
Yeah. So I don't want that. I don't want that. And I don't want my kids to deal with that either. So to your point, I'm willing to be a little bit, nutty about this stuff so that when I croak, it's fast, hopefully pretty painless, and that's it, you know, not a big drug out affair like my parents left me.
Oh my gosh. All right.
Well, Elijah, you know, on that completely heartwarming note, let folks know where they can track you down on the interwebs.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Okay. So yes, on a lighter note, so I have a podcast called The Obstacle Order. I co-host that with my friend Philip Levy, and your friend Matt Brown is like our social media guy. He makes sure that it's out there, and it's the obstacleorderpodcast.com. We talk about obstacle course racing, recovery tactics, nutrition, performance, how to improve performance. We interview coaches, we interview athletes. At some point we're gonna have Rob Wolf on the show. It's gonna be awesome.
I will bring property down, the values down, anytime you want, so just let me know.
Yeah. And you know, for the most part, that's it. I have a blog. It's elijahmarkstrom.com. I have to admit I have not been posting on there as much lately, but I've done a ton of work on you know, my experience with carbohydrates, my U-biome experiment, different. And I've moved on to doing like race reports, stuff like that. And then, yeah, look out for my book, The Stoplight Diet. I'll be creating a little landing page website for that shortly. And I think it's going to be good. And so that's where you can find me.
Awesome, man. Well, we'll have all those links in the show notes. Super stoked to get you on the show. Like I think I told you before we started recording, like I've listened to that interview that Grace had with you on her podcast, like about six times, just like taking notes on it and everything. So I learned a ton from that, and you had been someone on my mind to have on the show. And then Matt reached out to me and he's like, "Hey, would you like to have Elijah on there?" I'm like, "Hell yes, I would." So I'm stoked. Nice. You had the time to come on the show.
Gosh, well, I hope your listeners can get something out of it. And it's been my pleasure.
Well, looking forward to meeting you in real life, and definitely keep me posted on how the book is progressing, and we'll get you back on the show when that thing's ready.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
All right, man. Well, have a great rest of your day. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.